the first thing is that we encourage people to ask questions and to dig deeper. I mean, you know, a global list that's weighted based on the population, of course, is going to reveal certain stories. But as we've kind of alluded to throughout this entire discussion, when you get into some of those more nuanced stories or targeted stories, whether it's geographic, demographic, category-based, or even brand-based, there's a lot more to the story, and the data's there. It's available. It's transparent. It's there for the taking, so that people can actually leverage it in the way that they make informed sponsorship decisions.
Hi everyone, and welcome once again to the Sports Pro Podcast. My name is Owen Connolly. I'm the editor at large at Sports Pro. Hope you're well. We are going to be diving into the third and final one of our 50 most marketable lists for 2021, the 50 most marketable properties. Delighted to be joined in this exercise by Adam Mitchell, Chief Executive at our partners in the Most Marketable Properties Project, Sponsor Pulse. Hello, Adam.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Doing great, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Glad to hear it and very pleased to have you with us. Lots to dive into, lots to understand about how this list has been pulled together and what it tells us about where the sports industry is at this moment in time and what we can expect going into 2022 and hopefully a kind of fuller expression, shall we say, of the sports industry after the last couple of years. The full list is available along with the most marketable athletes and brands lists at the portal at 50mm.sportspromedia.com, but we can give you a quick flavour before we dive in. The FIFA World Cup tops the list, followed by the Summer Olympic Games, the NBA, two sports teams then, Real Madrid and Barcelona, and then the top 10 rounded out by the Winter Olympics, the UEFA Champions League, the Euros, UEFA European Championship, Manchester United and the Premier League. And we'll get into a few of those stories and a few outside of those in the rest of the top 50 as we go. But Adam, first of all, what's the philosophy behind the 50 most marketable properties list? What purpose does it serve? And what can it tell us about the industry more widely?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think at the end of the day, our goal and our intent has always been to provide the consumer's point of view. I think there's obviously a lot that we read in the news around the evolution of the sports industry, the evolution of consumption habits, and how consumers are going about consuming different sports among other things and among other passion points. But our goal and really the purpose of the 50 most marketable is to provide that consumer perspective as to how do these properties stack up to one another on the global scale. And we believe that the consumer's perspective is truly the great equalizer when we have the opportunity to ask them specifically how they feel about different sports properties. And this list, I think, reveals a lot about some of the strongest properties that exist in the world and the opportunities that they present to brands, obviously looking to connect with those consumers through different mediums and channels.
Yeah. And in common with the other two lists to date, it's built solely on data, digital marketing data. But what's the methodology that's been employed here?
Yeah, absolutely. So the methodology in Sponsor Pulse has been around for over 2.5 years now. So we've been tracking thousands of properties that go well beyond the world of sport. We track properties across music, entertainment, lifestyle, culture, causes, charities. Sports, however, is obviously the lion's share of the vast majority of the properties that we cover and that we track in our database. We actually are in market across 18 countries every month, surveying over 30,000 people. New people every month. So the total composition and surveys that make up this year's top 50 most marketable properties for 2021 exceeds 360,000 people across those 18 countries. The way in which that we go about tracking these properties and the health of each of these sponsorship opportunities is we have 7 key metrics that cover behavioral, emotional, and the potential impact that brands can expect to receive by sponsoring properties And we roll those up into a proprietary score, which we call the opportunity score. And the opportunity score is what we've used to define and to instantly rank the global top 50 most marketable properties. I think one really important note around the countries that we are in, we do cover about 75% of the global GDP. But we weight the opportunity scores based on the population size. So that certainly is an important factor to consider when we look at how exactly this list breaks out. And as we dig deeper into some of the themes that that will come out of this year's list, I think our intent has always been around providing transparent data that all parties within the sponsorship landscape can rely on. So properties, brands, agencies, rights holders, whoever you are, we are a source of transparent, credible data that provides that consumer perspective.
And obviously, you had a year to get this thing on its feet last year. You're pushing on ahead again with it this year with a similar methodology. How did you evolve that? What were you trying to ascertain, and what were some of the factors that you had to think about when you were doing that?
Yeah, I mean, for starters, obviously, as you kind of alluded to earlier, the industry has gone through a really rough couple of years with the impact of the pandemic. Obviously, the way that the pandemic has impacted scheduling or even COVID protocol and fan experience. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And nobody probably got away unscathed. However, I think a big part of this exercise and continuing to measure these properties in a consistent format, consistent manner, has allowed us to also provide a lot of context to some of the dialogue that we've seen or some of the headlines that we've seen. A lot of media have said, you know, sponsorship will never be the same, or sponsorship will never return, live events will never be the same. And it's just untrue. The consumer's perspective and the consumer data that we have and that we've collected have shown, in most cases, not all cases, small dips in engagement levels, which could certainly be, you know, as a factor of the evolving schedules that we've seen, or the way that a number of different properties have had to either put on hold or postpone events. However, the impacts certainly are not what they necessarily have been made out to be in a lot of the industry news that we're seeing. So I think that's why, as I referred to earlier, you know, the consumer's perspective, having that ongoing pulse to how do they feel, how are they engaging with, how do they react to sponsors of these properties, really has allowed us to take an objective view and provide that objective view to the industry. When I think a lot of decision makers have been, you know, tasked with and forced to reevaluate the way that they're spending every dollar, and to validate the value that they offer to, you know, to brands in the sponsorship landscape. So I think that's been a big part of this exercise, and seeing how consumers have, you know, evolved with the times, the challenging times that we've had. And I think that the data is and certainly points to I think a very positive story around the resilience of the sports industry at large that we can now highlight through the top 50 most marketable properties list.
Okay, just as we're just going to dive into the list in a second, but before we do, other than, as you say, some of the dynamics around the pandemic and particularly rescheduling, what are some of the other things that we're seeing reflected in the list this year, just at a very top level, before we start getting some of the individual stories?
Yeah, no, I think there's some really interesting themes that come out. I mean, I think the dominance of the top five having gone unchanged and staying and holding true to their positions, I think is quite telling just to the global relevance that some of these properties have built. I think that said, beyond the top five, there has been quite a bit of jockeying. I mean, there are a number of properties, whether it be within cricket or motorsport, that have made significant inroads and have improved their ranking or joined the list newly this year. But there are also some major properties that don't necessarily make the list that may surprise people and catch people off guard. Whether that be, you know, golf, for example, is essentially non-existent on the list. And what does that tell us about that particular sport and the way and the opportunities, frankly, that sport has? Tennis had a tough year with all the majors ranking in the top 50, but all dropping quite a few positions versus a year ago. So I think that there's a lot to dig into the nuances of a global list and how that obviously takes shape based on the different nations that we study and evaluate these properties in, and reveals, I think, quite a lot to digest and to consider as properties go about their commercialization efforts, as well as their branding efforts to connect with and grow their fan bases. And then for brands to really try to understand where is the value and where are the greatest opportunities for either global relevance, local relevance, to continue to obviously connect with their consumers in a deeper, more meaningful way.
Okay, let's have a look at the list then in a bit more detail, and we'll start at the top. The FIFA World Cup, number one. How's that set itself apart? What story is that telling? How's that attracting people? Is it a simple case of it's the most prestigious event in the world's biggest sport?
I don't think it's actually that close of a or that much of a slam dunk. I think the data tells a pretty interesting story. I mean, there's no question based on the top 10 properties, even the top 5 properties, that you know football is the global sport. And is a dominant force throughout the top 10 and the top 50, frankly, in terms of just that global appeal, that global reach, the frequency of engagement, the passion for these teams that that has been built up over, obviously, a long period of time. I think the FIFA World Cup, of course, is able to tap into that national pride factor. However, I think really interestingly, when we look at those 18 countries, the FIFA World Cup is actually only ranked the number one property in 2 of those 18 countries. So when you think about what that means, Mexico and Brazil, FIFA World Cup is the top ranked sports property. However, in all other countries, FIFA World Cup is always there in the top 10, but not necessarily ringing at the top or coming out at the top. I think there's some interesting things that we see around, you know, especially with Europe, a lot of the of the local leagues and the teams are the ones that are really pulling ahead of FIFA World Cup. So I think that there's an interesting storyline there around, you know, how those things are interconnected. I think with some of the more developing countries, and I can speak as a Canadian, that, you know, we had a big win last night, 4-1 against Panama in the qualifiers. You know, FIFA World Cup ranks as the number 6 sports property here in Canada. And we frankly haven't really been in contention for a long time. So I think that there's a really interesting mix of factors that are at play when you look at FIFA World Cup. But obviously there's been lots of headlines as of late in terms of some of the potential changes to the calendar and to the way that they go about competing, that I think it'll be interesting to see how it all washes out and where they net out with that potential biennial approach.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that in just a second, but interesting what you mentioned there about the national pride element of it. I suppose one of the things that a global tournament like the World Cup has, particularly when it has the universality that that football has, soccer has, even though it may be there or thereabouts in most countries, it's working across two dynamics, basically, isn't it? It's that global appeal, but also when there is a World Cup on, or the qualifiers get to the business end, intense local focus on that competition as well.
Yeah, of course, we see it. I mean, we see it all the time. And I think the Olympics, there's no question, has that same kind of universal appeal, but also that local relevance that the FIFA World Cup has. So I think it's just an interesting dynamic that, you know, really enables the property to benefit from the fact that they have the global stage, they're longer periods of time, they're high frequency throughout those periods of time. That the tournament is in play, and obviously capitalizing on that national pride factor is a huge element of the value of the property and why it climbs to the top as the top property for 2 years in a row now.
Yeah, and what are the implications of this for a biennial World Cup? What is there anything that the data is telling you about the consistency of that interest? Whether really it's a quadrennial spike in some of the big territories, whether there's the appetite. I mean, I think it's pretty well accepted that you probably don't double the appeal of it by having it every 2 years, but would it be a sustainable thing for FIFA to expand the presence of the World Cup across the calendar?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. So, I mean, the data would suggest, or from our tracking, that, you know, obviously they already have significant global reach. So are you going to reach more people? I mean, at this point, frankly, there might be an opportunity to engage some new audiences, but we think that the reach component is probably fairly close to where it's going to be. I think the bigger opportunity for FIFA and all of the sponsors involved with the FIFA World Cup is the frequency factor. So, you know, when we look at the, our funnel and the key metrics that we evaluate, frequency and intensity of engagement is a huge component, because we measure and we can quantify the number of people who are engaging with the property on a weekly basis or more, which is hugely valuable for the property and also for all sponsors or all those who are involved in terms of having additional connection points or, you know, 50 plus connection points with that particular consumer over the course of a year. So naturally, when you're operating in a quad format, going to a biannual approach would give you, you know, significantly more frequency. The challenge, as I kind of alluded to earlier, though, which I think remains to be seen how it all plays out, is that the proposal would have a significant impact on the calendar and the way that a lot of the local leagues and teams, you know, on their schedules and how they go about competing through their calendars. And the reality is that in a lot of markets, as I alluded to earlier, the, you know, whether it's Premier League or whether it's Serie A or whether it's La Liga, a lot of those properties will actually outperform, outrank, and a lot of the teams within those leagues will outperform and outrank FIFA World Cup in their respective countries. So I think the question is, I mean, could it drive frequency? Of course. Could that be more valuable for the property and for the sponsors? For sure. But at what expense? And are consumers going to allow it or welcome it at the expense of some of the properties and teams that they're so passionate about day in and day out? So I think that's really what we'll have to see, you know, over the next coming months as that dialogue continues to evolve.
One event property that we're seeing more of across a 6 to 8 month period, but not deliberately, is the Olympic Games. Tokyo 2020 taking place after a year's delay this summer. Beijing 2022, obviously captured separately as the Winter Olympic Games, taking place just a few months from now. What was the effect of that delay to the Summer Olympics?
I mean, I think that there's no question that it had a massive impact on all those who were directly involved in terms of, you know, the national committee, the IOC, the athletes, most importantly, obviously the fans, and obviously not having the opportunity to have fans in the stands, and in most cases, and of course, the broadcasters and sponsors. I mean, whether it was, you know, we've seen through the follow-up of the games, a lot of the broadcasters, you know, went out and shared the reality that, you know, the viewership wasn't exactly, wasn't close to where they expected or wanted it to be. But I think that, there were some highlights. I mean, you know, you look at the 100 meter final and, you know, the peak viewership for that particular event, you look at some of the new events that debuted, whether it be skateboarding, surfing, speed climbing, the return of baseball, softball, you know, a lot of, I think, positive news for the Summer Olympic Games. But there definitely is a theme that is recurring with, you know, a number of the games having taken place in Asia, that the time zone is a huge challenge for the Americas, which I think is just, it's become very clear over the last few games, and will continue to be, I think, you know, one of the unfortunate realities of the games being in Asia for the upcoming Beijing Winter Olympic Games. However, I think there are some things that are working in its favor. You know, the return of the NHL to hockey, like, will be an important factor in driving viewership. Also, a huge opportunity for the NHL to extend its presence and relevance in obviously a massive market for them. One of the things that we have been tracking over the past couple of months that we continue to track is just general awareness of the upcoming Beijing Olympics and the anticipated engagement with the Olympics. And we can say that it's, you know, from an awareness perspective, there's quite a range. You know, in the UK, it's about 50% of people who are aware of the upcoming games, whereas in Japan, it's 76%, and lots of others, you know, falling somewhere in between. And I think the concerning thing is that, you know, awareness is one thing that can obviously be addressed as all the broadcasters go out with their big promotional plans. But the anticipated engagement levels are tracking softer than what we've seen in past years. They should start to pick up, of course, with everything as it kind of continues to gain traction and momentum, which we always see in our tracking, you know, four, 4 or 5 months out, you'll start to see that continued trajectory of growth and anticipation for the games. But certainly is something that we're keeping a close eye on across the different countries that we track in to try to determine, you know, where we think Beijing will land from an overall viewership and audience perspective.
What kind of changes are we seeing in the Olympic program in the Olympic platform, I should say? And how are some of those reflected in the data that you're picking up?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, one, over the last several years, it's not necessarily new news, but the Olympics has made a very intentional effort to, you know, expand its content delivery across, you know, all platforms and frankly throughout the entire year. I think one of the things with FIFA World Cup, as we just kind of spoke to, and as well as with the Olympic Games, is there's that perception of, oh, well, it's only once, you know, every 2 to 4 years, depending on how you look at it. But the reality is that there's a ton of content that's being you know, shared and distributed throughout the year around the athletes and the stories of those athletes and how they came to be, or around the growth of certain sports or the rise of new sports, or the discussion and the conversation around esports becoming, you know, an opportunity or a sport within the Olympic Games. So I think that there's been a very like intentional effort from their part to become a more 365 opportunity and content offering through the Olympic Channel, and a lot of their efforts that obviously disseminate down into, you know, the local broadcasters, and I think that it's certainly paying off and creates a much more compelling offer for the sponsorship market to look at a property that has that global appeal, that global relevance, but that isn't just, you know, a 2 week dip in and out, but that really offers like a platform that brands can speak to throughout the course of an entire year.
And then completing the top three, first National League to make it on the list ahead of the Premier League, ahead of the UEFA Champions League, although that's not a National League, but it is a year-round competition, and ahead of the NFL is the NBA, number three. Why is it that that's landing differently from other national competitions, other year-round competitions in global sport?
Yeah, I think the narrative there, when we look at it and break it down by country among the 18 countries that we're in, is that the NBA dominates in the US, they dominate in China, and they also have a really significant dominance in Canada and Australia. But those are frankly the top four markets, and really the US and China, when you look at the weighted you know, global population and the way that this global list is generated, are really the driving forces. So I think the NBA's, you know, their efforts to really become and to be a global entity, I think for probably a longer period of time than a lot of the other major leagues that it competes with, are like, it certainly has paid off. I think we see that there's a massive opportunity for the NBA in Europe and in South America in particular. Obviously, with their announcement of NBA Africa, there's a significant commitment that they've made to continuing to be a global entity and building the sport globally. But we're excited to see what they have planned, you know, to expand and to tap into the European market as well as the South American market, where we see just like a land of opportunity for them. Whereas I think a lot of the other leagues, frankly, certainly, you know, North American ones, are playing a bit of catch up and trying to figure out, you know, how to build their sport in a meaningful way across the global landscape. So that's where, you know, when you look at, you know, the NHL not participating in the Olympic Games or in this case now, thankfully, participating in the Olympic Games, like, you know, massive opportunity to tap into a new audience and to obviously build their property, grow their fan base. But I think the NBA has just taken a more concerted effort to establish that global footprint and to continue to reinforce that message of being the global game or a global game, which is certainly paying off. So if they can continue to make, you know, inroads and kind of copy over the playbook of what they've done, you know, in China and some other markets, like in Europe, I think that they're poised to certainly continue to disrupt. And I think, frankly, could overtake, you know, the Olympic Games and FIFA World Cup in the coming years.
Also a league that's athlete-led. There's a lot of high-profile athletes there, and they tend to be more visible in that sport than perhaps than some competing leagues. And
yeah, absolutely.
Known for being pretty innovative, pretty experimental in its approach to digital media in particular.
Absolutely. I think, you know, whether it be, you know, the integration or the intersection of, you know, entertainment in the NBA with The Last Dance on documentary on Netflix, whether it be, you know, the rise of the intersection of fashion and basketball with, you know, everything that we see in terms of how players are obviously coming to the forefront and showing up to their games, whether it be the increased interest and I think investment that a lot of those players are making in technology or in other sports or in other industries, I think absolutely they're certainly benefiting from the appeal and the and the way in which that their athletes are carrying themselves and the different passion points that those athletes are tapping into. It's tough to there's essentially a basketball player for everybody that they can kind of relate to across a multitude of passion points beyond just the game that's taking place on the court.
Lessons there, I'm sure, for other properties as well. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll look at a few more stories that have emerged from this year's list and take a step back and look at a few of the wider trends as well. Back in a sec. Hope you're enjoying the latest podcast in our 50 Most Marketable series, but we just wanted to take a moment to tell you about the Sports Pro OTT Summit. It is the essential event for the digital broadcast and streaming sector, and it returns in a hybrid format from the 15th to the 18th of November. We're thrilled to be having 2 days back in person, including the Sports Pro OTT Awards here in London at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. And then we have another 2 days of digital sessions after that. There is a world-class speaker lineup and the audience will be full of key decision makers from right across the industry. If you want to find out more, you can head to sportspro-ott.com. Better yet, you can tell them we sent you and you'll get a healthy discount. Use the offer code POD30 to get 30% off the cost of your pass. That's POD30, POD30, for 30% off your pass to the Sports Pro OTT Summit. Get over to sportspro-ott.com to take advantage. It'll be great to see you all again. Welcome back to the Sports Pro podcast. Three sports teams, Adam, in the top 10 of the most marketable properties list. Real Madrid and Barcelona in at 4 and 5, and then Manchester United down in 9th. What's the difference in how, in terms of how team brands connect relative to competition brands in an exercise like this?
It's a great question. I mean, when we look at Real Madrid and Barcelona and the way that they stack up to one another across all the countries that we're active in, I mean, they're jockeying for positions, but the delta is not significant. I mean, they're both just powerhouses. I think, you know, long history, long tradition, performance is obviously a key component. And I think similar to what we were, you know, referring to previously around the NBA, I mean, you know, they've certainly leveraged the athletes as ambassadors for the sport, ambassadors for the team, which I think has certainly paid dividends. I think one of the really interesting things that we always look at is the strength of the team in the home nation of the star player. So, for example, Barcelona in Argentina, where Messi's from, is an absolute powerhouse, and that's one of the markets where we actually do see a considerable difference in the size and the opportunity score of Barcelona versus Real Madrid. So I think it'll be really interesting for us to see, as you kind of alluded to, the top three teams, and obviously there's been a lot of shifting within the world of football, and certainly of some of those major names like Ronaldo and like Messi, to see how that will influence this list over the next year as things shake out. The other thing that we keep a very close eye on is essentially how these teams are tracking in developing markets or in, you know, in new markets. So, for example, Barcelona ranks in the top 10 properties in India. Real Madrid doesn't quite crack it. They're not far out. But Real Madrid ranks in the top 10 in China, whereas Barcelona doesn't quite crack it. So I think that there's a really interesting positioning component here where these teams are obviously seeing that they have huge global appeal and there's massive opportunities for them to continue to build their fan bases, which leads to obviously, you know, commercialization opportunities for those teams and for the brands that that want to be a part of those narratives in a lot of those other markets. There's no surprise or no, everybody's aware that there's been a number of shakeups in terms of new offices being opened by different clubs, teams, leagues, in different kind of expansion opportunity areas. So I think that that's something that we'll continue to see. And I think that these two teams are just, they're poised and positioned to continue to thrive. I think it'll be just an interesting and telling story to see how, you know, these clubs, as well as, you know, what the Ronaldo factor is when he or as he heads back to Man U, and what that impact might be on Juventus, which is also, you know, a club that that cracks the top 50 list as well, as they kind of continue to evolve with in an era post Ronaldo.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fair bit of depth, particularly among European football teams and NBA teams, when it comes to the rest of the list, that top 50. And then you start to see other sports, IPL and a few others, motorsport represented the deeper down the list you go. But just reflecting on that point you made about the connections between individuals and those teams, you know, how deep-rooted would you say some of these fan bases are? How are we, particularly among those towards the top of the list, are we going to see that much churn, that much turnover, or is it quite difficult to say given how the media market's evolving? What do you think in that respect?
It's a great question. So I mean, I think there's a lot of the narrative in the marketplace, obviously there's a lot of people out there saying that, you know, as soon as Ronaldo's gone, you know, the fan base is gone, or Messi's gone to PSG and the fan base is moving with him. We generally do not see that. And I think that that's why we continue to track the consumer's perspective, because it is the equalizer and there is a lot of noise out there. We're not necessarily suggesting that, you know, social media followings or audiences won't change, obviously. But when we look at the big picture in terms of the overall global reach of these properties, the frequency of engagement, the passion for those teams, a lot of those things are deep, deep, deep rooted in kind of the consumer's DNA and how they've been brought up and what their experiences have been. So I think it's an important, it's not necessarily the only factor to consider, of course, when you're looking at, you know, these properties and what opportunities you may want to go after or tackle. However, I think it's a really important part of the equation that helps drown out some of the noise that's out there around, how significant the impact could be of having some of these star players or individuals moving from team to team to team. Mm-hmm. We just generally don't see a massive impact or dip on the property's strength overall when a player leaves.
Okay, I'm going to take a quick step outside traditional sports for a few moments. The name at number 11 on the list. It's not the only esports property, but it's the highest ranked this year. It's League of Legends. You know, that's kind of established itself, I suppose, as the premier brand in esports, although there is some fairly intense competition. But it's done a pretty good job of commercializing itself and kind of creating that overlap with mainstream sport and entertainment in some respects. But how do esports brands, how do esports communities behave differently when you're observing them through a lens like this?
Yeah, I mean, the esports market and the industry at large is super fascinating, obviously, to us, as well as I'm sure to everybody in the industry. I mean, League of Legends in and of itself, and really the driving force of it being, you know, just outside that top 10, it's really driven by China and by Germany. Those are the two countries where League of Legends really pops and cracks at the top three properties. It is the number one property in China. So I think that there's some really interesting things that we can learn when we look at the global picture of how League of Legends, among all other esports entities, really perform. And I think there's obviously more developed markets and less developed markets, and the catch up and how those markets are evolving and how esports is gaining traction, or how different organizations within esports are gaining traction in different areas, I think is a really interesting story to help color in, you know, the picture of like what exactly is this opportunity and where are the greatest opportunities based on the markets, because not all markets obviously are the same. Like when we look at what's so different, I mean, obviously the consumption opportunities from a content perspective are just like infinite. So the frequency factor is one, or the intensity of engagement is one that certainly is a driving force behind the power of esports, given, yes, obviously you have, you know, those marquee tournaments. We're in the thick of the League of Legends World Championship right now in Iceland. But the ability to, you know, consume content through a variety of different channels to participate, to follow the ambassadors or the people who are obviously competing or who are influencers within their own right, within their any of these different titles. I think there's a relatability and approachability to esports and to gaming at large that certainly are driving it forward. One of the really interesting factors, though, beyond the intensity of engagement, is the passion that these different organizations have generated in such a relatively speaking, short period of time. So I think the fact in the way that they're able to mobilize their audience into a passionate fan base, and in some cases faster than, you know, sports leagues and teams have been around for more than a century is pretty fascinating to see. So it's something that we're keeping a close eye on to see how different markets are moving in that direction or not, but it's certainly something that that shines a light on the opportunity that exists within the esports space and gaming space at large. One of the things that we always talk about is that, yes, like esports is esports, but gaming is so much bigger than esports. And I think that that's one of the things that's really working in its favor is that, you know, every person who games is, you know, there's a lot more there to the community that these different esports entities or gaming entities are building. It's not just about gaming. It's a lot more about lifestyle, about culture. I think as a result, because they have that wider net that they can draw upon, whether it's, you know, the intersection of gaming with fashion, culture, music, whatever it may be, I think it's created a very powerful movement. And we can see that based on the pace at which they're able to build a passionate base of engaged fans and people who are obviously very active and following some of these different organizations.
Yeah, it's interesting. And of course, there's a participative element to gaming in particular that draws people into community and lets them interact with it in different ways.
Absolutely.
Speaking of crossovers, at number 20 in the list, we have that fabled sports entertainment property, the WWE. What are they able to do differently, and what does that tell us as well, you know, about what other sports properties can learn, particularly in that content space and original storytelling? Yeah. And editorial.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the WWE is such an incredible example of what we're seeing and how powerful the sports entertainment or the intersection of sports with, frankly, any other passion point or area. And people are starting to take notice and to I think, steal with pride and copy what the WWE has done for such a long time, which is, you know, generate original content and powerful storylines and deliver a product that's, I think, you know, really quite fascinating and interesting, where they pull you in and have you wanting more to see what's happening or how the story is evolving. And I think they've done a very good job of becoming and putting themselves on the global map. I think as a result of their success, there are a lot of new entrants into the wrestling space that are giving them a real run for their money, whether it be All Elite Wrestling, AAA, New Japan, Ring of Honor. I mean, the list goes on of these new entities that have come in to try to capitalize on different market opportunities that where the WWE may not be as strong. So I think the competition is fierce because people are looking at the playbook that the WWE has built and essentially trying to replicate. I think the other thing which we've talked to throughout and which I think is something that's certainly been discussed through the top 50 most marketable athletes list is that, you know, the entertainment personalities, the athletes that are in the ring and the way that they move or the different, whether they're with the WWE or moving on to other entities, certainly has a pretty big impact on how these organizations are continuing to grow and develop their fan bases. So I think there's the competition's, I think, just starting to heat up, but I think it will continue to heat up just given the sheer size and magnitude of the WWE. And, you know, we're tracking very closely how all these other wrestling properties are performing in different pockets of the world. And at a global level, none of them are necessarily knocking on the door. But certainly when we look at the more local level in specific markets, the story changes. And there's some pretty stiff competition that the WWE is up against So it'll be really interesting to see how they continue to evolve their calendar and those marquee moments, and also to see what some of these competitors do from a content perspective to continue to kind of chomp away and steal share from the WWE.
Okay. We've got a few minutes left, so let's explore some of the wider themes, some of the things bubbling under in this list. And one that jumps out at me, particularly when you look at the composition of the most marketable athletes list and how many female athletes were gravitating towards the top there, is the presence of some female-led properties. The WTA is in there in the top 50, but if you go outside the top 50, you've got the likes of the WNBA, you've got England's FA Women's Super League making an appearance. We're going to see more and more of these, aren't we, in the next few years?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, we've got the Women's World Hockey Championship in there as well. I mean, there's, I think it's, there's no question that these properties are they're just starting out. I mean, the gains are there. When you look at where these different properties are on the list, how they stack up to other properties on this list, and then the relative size of, you know, exposure that they get, or the sponsorship dollars and revenue that the different leagues or teams or properties are pulling in, you know, we're not even scratching the surface yet. I think it's great to see that there is some momentum, you know, in that lane, but like the data points to, there's massive opportunities here, and brands, broadcasters should be taking note and trying to find ways to be a part of that story and to ensure that the exposure is given, because there's no question that people want it. People want the content. We just need to make it more available and level the playing field, which, as I said, I think we're only starting, but the data and providing that consumer perspective and the global view certainly helps showcase just how significant the opportunity is relative to some of the other properties on this list that are getting hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in revenue from a sponsorship perspective. So use the data, follow the data, and let it lead you to where the opportunities lie. And I think the brands and the broadcasters and the different players that are getting involved now are certainly going to reap the benefits. And obviously these female-led properties are going to continue to, I think, rise in the ranks of this top 50 most marketable properties list. The fact that they're there with the, frankly, limited exposure that they've received to date is already super telling. So I think that we'll continue to keep a very close eye on how that story evolves.
Mm. And where do you think some of those gains are going to be reflected? What's the next step?
Yeah, I mean, to be candid, like anything, you've got to start with reach, with like the overall engaged audience. So when you think about like, you know, distribution deals or access to content, you know, with the Women's Champions League and it being now broadcast through YouTube and DAZN, I mean, that's like, those are the opportunities that exist that are going to just instantly, I think, expand the reach and the audience size of these properties. They're also going to provide the opportunity to engage more frequently because it'll be more regular access to content as opposed to, you know, the occasional viewing opportunity. So I think at the top of the funnel, the reach and the frequency of that reach is going to be hugely important and is going to be the first step. And naturally, as you're able to establish a more frequent interaction with consumers or with fans, you'll be able to build that passionate fan base. Which obviously is a bit more of like the long tail, but certainly will be an output of I think the increased reach that and exposure that these properties get over the next couple of years.
What are some of the other deeper trends that you'd point to in this list this year?
Yeah, I think there's the rise of cricket globally is definitely something that we're monitoring closely, country by country. But certainly something that that nobody should be ignoring. People should be, you know, should be at least vetting and seeing, you know, what the opportunity looks like for their brands. The rise of motorsport. Obviously, I think motorsport's done a lot of the right things over the past several years. And, you know, as we talked about that intersection of entertainment with sports, whether it's, you know, the Drive to Survive or some of the docs that have come out around Formula E, like there's lots that the motorsport industry is doing, I think, to increase its relevance and appeal to a broader audience, which is I think great to see. We're keeping a close eye on properties like table tennis and badminton that, you know, have really strong really strong, I think, engaged fan bases in parts of the world, but are certainly obviously, I think, doing a lot of the right things to and investing, I think, a lot in developing or evolving the production around those sports and the content opportunities that exist and that come from it to ensure that they're building their fan bases globally. So those are some of the kind of the themes or the overarching stories that we're seeing. Tennis is one that we kind of alluded to or that we talked to earlier. I mean, tough year, but will be interesting to see how, you know, they rebound over the coming years. And I think we continue to expect to see a lot of that cross-pollination. I mean, you know, Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney and, you know, their purchase of Wrexham AFC and obviously their plans to launch a documentary around community and the growth of that team and how what that team means to their community. I think those are the examples where you have, you know, the combination of the celebrity component, the team, and the stories that I think are going to become really, really powerful. And I think obviously a number of brands are going to want to be involved in jumping on that bandwagon. And I think a lot of people will steal with pride, as they frankly did from, you know, models that they've seen from other teams that have done similar types of executions to bring their stories to life in different ways for different audiences to consume beyond just what hits the field of play. So I think the innovation and then the cross-pollination of you know, athletes, celebrities, influencers, and passion points and how they kind of reference and work with sport, I think are certainly going to be key themes that we continue to keep an eye on. Golf is one that we're going to continue to keep an eye on. Obviously, a big year for Japan with both the men's and women's Masters wins. We're seeing that. We're seeing how it's, you know, it's growing in that country. Just has not really been able to strike a chord with the rest of the world. So no, lots of different storylines and things to dig into when we look at how this global list really disseminates down into a local list at a country level or across key demographics among youth or boomers or whatever it may be.
And we're going to have people listening to this podcast from a more practical level. They'll be with rights holders and teams in business development, in content, communications, in marketing. They might go and have a wade through the portal after listening to this podcast. What are some of the things that you would point them towards as being the most valuable metrics that, in terms of encouraging growth, things that, you know, are good barometers for people to keep an eye on?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the first thing is that we encourage people to ask questions and to dig deeper. I mean, you know, a global list that's weighted based on the population, of course, is going to reveal certain stories. But as we've kind of alluded to throughout this entire discussion, when you get into some of those more nuanced stories or targeted stories, whether it's geographic, demographic, category-based, or even brand-based, there's a lot more to the story. And the data's there. It's available. It's transparent. It's there for the taking, so that people can actually leverage it in the way that they make informed sponsorship decisions. I think the days of you know, making sponsorship decisions based on, you know, whatever the C-level is interested in, or purely based on relationship, I think those days are becoming fewer and fewer. And I think that there's a need for the industry to lean on different sources of data, not just consumer data, to really get a better understanding of where the opportunities lie, how not all opportunities are created equal, in the relative context and size of opportunities within sport and beyond sport. I think those are kind of some of the major key takeaways, to just keep asking questions and let the data and the insight guide you, and be open to you know, to uncovering different things, different opportunities that you might not have realized in the first place.
Mm. We're obviously coming to the end of this 50 Most Marketable project, the wider exercise for the year. We've had the athletes and brands lists, and now we are wrapping up with the properties list. How would you take those three together? What are some of the ways in which you see those interacting with each other?
Yeah, I think, I mean, from tuning in and seeing how the other lists have come to be, I think a lot of the discussion around 50 most marketable athletes, brands, and now properties have really revolved around the evolution of each of these individuals or entities, and the way that they're operating within, you know, a very dynamic and challenging environment, whether it be, you know, the pandemic, whether it be politics, whether it be, you know, the rise of you know, some really important cultural or sociopolitical issues. I think, you know, the reality is that athletes, brands, and properties all are expected from the consumer to take a stand and to have a point of view. And I think that these entities and individuals, as you know, separate, but also all together, have an incredible opportunity to provide a megaphone and to amplify, you know, the messages that are going and to contribute in a more meaningful way to society. So I think, you know, a big part of what we talk about with a lot of our clients and partners is, you know, how do you bring together, you know, the influencer, the celebrity, the athlete, the property, and the brand, but all rallying around a common cause, whether that be the environment, whether that be, you know, mental health or anti-bullying, whatever it may be. I think that there's an expectation that that comes with having the megaphone and having this global reach and dominance and opportunity in a lot of ways, that I think those, you know, we're starting to see that some of the properties that are taking a stand are, I think, standing, you know, head and shoulders above the others. So I think that's one thing that is really encouraging, and I think probably also, you know, challenging and scary for a lot of these properties. But I think those who rise to the occasion and who, you know, seize the opportunity to have a point of view, to bring the right people together, to have a meaningful conversation and contribute back to the communities that they are operating in, and to give back, I think are certainly going to be positioned for long-term growth. So we're excited to see how that conversation continues to evolve. We've been tracking the top causes globally for a number of years now, to help provide context to that story or to that picture, that obviously we hope people will take leverage and find ways to tap into, you know, something that is bigger than just sport, because I think sport is and has the opportunity to really bring people together across borders in a powerful and meaningful way.
Absolutely, let's hope so. Last thing before we finish up, what are some of the ways in which you think this list is going to change in the years ahead? And you know, what are the things informing that in terms of how digital media, digital marketing, communication are going to change as well?
Yeah, I think that, like, over the more long-term view is, we know that the way in which, you know, youth are consuming sports is not the same. I mean, I just saw a press release this morning around TikTok becoming a helmet sponsor of the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. But I think that there's a lot of change and evolution that's taking place in the space around how people are consuming content, how youth are consuming content, and how they have an overflow of content at their fingertips. So I think, you know, the fan experience, the different consumption opportunities, different content types and formats. I think obviously betting being a huge component of where the sports world is going are all going to be really critical factors to driving engagement, but also importantly driving that frequency of engagement, which is a huge part of the puzzle in ensuring that these properties stay relevant throughout an entire calendar year as opposed to dropping in and out. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how some of those different themes kind of continue to evolve. And then, as I said, I think the cross-pollination of sport with other passion points and areas that are of interest to people at large is really, I think, proving to be super effective and important for properties to grow and to stand for something beyond just, you know, the sport itself or the product on the field of play. And I think that the consumers have spoken and said, you know, like they want to see what these organizations stand for beyond just the sport itself. So we'll be excited to see how that continues to evolve over the next several years and how the different opportunities that are created and the innovation that comes from, you know, different content consumption opportunities will continue to, I think, you know, make for a very competitive market. But I think it's also a really interesting one where I think we're coming to a time where we will start to see, I think, a bit more, you know, a bit more jockeying of positions in this global ranking based on, you know, the organizations that are taking that to heart and finding new opportunities to engage new audiences.
Well, we'll look out for all of that, but it's been a compelling snapshot of where we are here in 2021. Adam Mitchell, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate the time, and look forward to 2022 and seeing what changes.
Good stuff. Thanks to all of you for listening as well. We'll be back with you again very soon. Bye-bye.
The Sports Pro Podcast is published by Sports Pro Media.